the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest this week is Dr. Drew Collins, and his subject will be preventing heart disease and how to recover from it if you have managed to get it in one form or another.
We often talk so often on this program about the goals of reaching retirement, how to get there, the different phases, and we look at retirement in a different way. We describe it in three different phases. There could be the pre-retirement phase, that's 5 to 10 years before you actually retire, or maybe you're fortunate enough to reach retirement at an early age. That would be the first phase. The second phase has to do with a lot of government laws. Age 59 and a half to age 66. At age 59 and a half, you can actually have access to your IRAs and pension plans and start withdrawing money without a penalty. And at age 66, you can get full retirement benefits from Social Security, continue to work, and not get penalized. And finally, the third phase of retirement is age 66, when you actually reach the full retirement age, to the rest of your life. The simple facts are today, people are actually living longer. When you think about it, when Social Security was first put into effect, the average life expectancy of a male in this country was 65 years. Today, it's almost close to 80, and for women, it's even higher. We all seen the advances in medicine, but the simple fact is medical expenses are rising, and especially since the passage of Obamacare. And we're also in a low interest rate environment, something that we viewed from afar about Japan, zero interest rates. Well, they've been here for almost 7 years, and it's been a more difficult investment environment. It's been more controlled by central bank liquidity than any other measure.
And if you've listened to a lot of our programs here, you'll know that we have discussed on many occasions the fact that people are indeed working longer. They actually want to do that in some cases. Some just simply start working part-time, maybe even doing the vocation they worked at before. They just don't want to be there 8 hours a day working at it. Some people who have been retired have had to go back to work. And we've discussed about retirees getting into financial straits once they're in retirement because they didn't plan adequately. So we'd like to talk about how to stay retired. Maybe another way to look at it is how to protect what you made once you made it. And we'll take a page right out of the chapter today, Why the Rich Keep Getting Richer.
And so we're going to cover two topics today. If you're retired, how to protect it. How to stay retired. You don't want to end up retiring at age 65 or 66 and find out at age 76 you don't have enough money to live out your retirement years. You're still in good health, or medical expenses are eating into the budget. So we're going to talk about if you're retired, how to protect it, and if you're rich, how to get richer. So let's begin with some basics. Now, the best known way to protect a nest egg has always been diversification. It seems simple, but in actual reality, very few investors practice it. There's a tendency today to go all in when some kind of investment trend is trending. Think of, for example, CDs in the 80s. I mean, why invest in stocks? I remember very well because I was in the business. It was the first decade of my career. Why would you want to invest in stocks? Heck, you were getting 12, 14% at the bank and a free Vegematic and a toaster. Then we got to the 90s, and in the 90s, well, from 95 to 2000, all you had to do was buy a tech mutual fund, or even most growth mutual funds were primarily invested in tech stocks. And we all know that the new economy that eliminated the business cycle, well, by 2001, we were in another recession and a bear market. In the last decade, it seemed like almost brainless to buy gold, to buy commodities, the emerging markets. And that's what people did. In real estate, we saw double-digit returns in real estate, something we hadn't seen in half a century. That was the trend. And what happened is people tended to load up in one area. In 2011, largest influx into gold and silver of almost the last decade, right at the very peak, just as from 1995 to 2000, investors loaded up on tech stocks. So whenever trends become secular, it catches on with the public. There's usually a story that Wall Street and the media will sell to you. And as we know, there are three major waves in any bull market or bear market. The first wave is the smart money that recognizes the value. By phase two of a bull market, it's institutions. In phase three, the public finally catches on. I can remember in the late 90s when people were making fun of Warren Buffett. He wasn't buying tech stocks. He was buying things like financial stocks. He was buying things like Coca-Cola. He was buying simple things that people have to use on a daily basis, like Gillette. Every day, guys get up and have to shave. Well, where are we now? 2014, Warren Buffett is the second richest man in the world. So it may sound like it's an easy thing to think about to protect your assets. Diversification has and always been a way to protect it, but very few people practice it.
You know, we do see this so often today. We can see this especially in emails, which we receive here. A lot of times people let their political views and beliefs get in the way of rational decisions. I remember a long time ago, Jim, you had a client and she finally decided to disinvest with you, so to speak, because she didn't like one or two of your political positions. You know, the issue isn't, was Jim planning everything well, and is my portfolio doing well? It was, well, gee, if you think this way politically, you can't possibly be a good money manager. And I thought that was the dumbest thing I'd ever heard. You know, the two weren't really quite connected in that same area. This really became pronounced after 2008, because while you and I both have talked extensively about being prepared for emergencies, you can also take it into the doomsday prepper motif, who typically move into precious metals, gold, cash, or bonds, or other things like that, that they can rapidly transact in a time of crisis, theoretically, assuming that it's going to be a Mad Max scenario and the banking system will just blow itself out. And that's going to be the end of it when it does, blah, blah, blah. You know, we've all heard it before. The problem was, as you said, I remember you began talking about the bull market back in 2001. By the time the preppers got around to it in 2008, it was rolling over. That was the time not to do it. And so with everybody expecting the worst, they were making the wrong decisions in the metals. They kept expecting the worst in the markets and sitting traumatized off on the sideline by, first of all, the financial crisis in 2007-08, and then by 0% interest rates. Let's face it, it wasn't worth investing in anything. The big problem was, in addition to not understanding what's going on, and I always remember that from my primary flight instructor years and years ago, it's almost 40 years ago now, he said, in any situation, do your best to understand what's actually going on, and then do whatever you need to do to deal with the situation. And I thought that was a terrific piece of wisdom, and it really applies in finances too. The biggest problem along that line is that people don't have a plan, and they don't have an investment strategy, and they tend to ricochet back and forth on an emotional basis or whatever the latest public stampede tends to be. And as you said, in the market area, stage three of a bull market is when the public gets in. That's when you should be rolling out.
Yeah, and the real problem that you have when a bull market begins, as I said, it has several phases. The first phase began in 2009, 2010. Investors looking at the value that was in stocks. Remember, the S&P got down to 666. The Dow got down to about 7,000. Today, it's at almost 18,000. And the problem in a bull market is prices go higher. What happens is investors say, oh, I missed it. I'll wait for the next pullback or the next crash. The problem is, all we get are these small corrections. And John, this happened last month. The beginning of October, stocks fell about 7%. The bears were out saying, this is it. People were bailing out of stocks. As quickly as stocks fell, they came back. And now we're even at higher levels. So the problem is, investors have, let's say, gone through the trauma of 2008 and 2009, are always expecting inclement weather. And there's definite patterns that we've talked about here in bull and bear markets. And the problem is nobody knows when they end, but there will be plenty of lead time, as we have talked so many times. The problem with trying to time these crashes, there's a definite sequence in terms of how bear markets come about. And there are plenty of signs that are evident that are in existence. And we've talked about this so many times on the weekend program, so I don't want to go through that here. But oftentimes market timing fails. And what happens is investors tend to make these one-way bets, and they turn investing into an all-or-nothing game. And we've seen this play out so many times over the last 4 years of investors who definitely thought the world was going to end, the dollar was going to crash. On the Monday that you will be listening to this program, the dollar is at almost record highs again. It reminds me of the hedge fund manager Kyle Bass saying that it's a widowmaker's strategy. So many hedge funds have blown up, gone out of business, and lost money. And it's something that we covered on the weekend program about this risk trade has many more years to run. And the problem is you're going against central banks. And a word of caution, you're going against a central bank, you're going to probably end up on the losing end of that trade. When they are loosening, you want to be invested. When they are tightening, you want to take to safety. But you only do that when they change their policy. So here we are in the seventh year of zero interest rates, and we may have 3 or 4 more years to go at these levels. So if you've been waiting for the crash, you may have to sit on the sidelines several more years. We'll eventually get one. You always do. When they print this kind of money, eventually you're going to get an asset bubble, something that Jeremy Grantham just wrote about. We will have another crash someday, but only when we get to bubble territory and we're not even close.
You know, we hear a lot about the disparity between the rich and the poor. That's a real political football that gets thrown around and used for political gain. And we do see that, which ironically is one of the things that happens in the end game of any kind of a currency. But, you know, you work with a lot of wealthy clients, and we have some lessons and wisdom that we can impart from experience. Like, what makes people who are able to amass wealth different? In other words, why the rich do keep getting richer? And what lessons we can impart to ourselves from them to what we can do, how these can carry over into retirement, either setting a trend or staying on a trend that works once they're retired.
Well, I mean, the first thing that you will see with somebody that has amassed some degree of success, a fortune and wealth, is they all had a plan, you know, unless somebody won the lottery. I mean, you see it. Whether they were CEOs of public corporations, they started their own private company. I mean, they had a plan. They had an operating budget. They knew how to manage cash flow of their business, but they had a plan of running the business that made them successful. These aren't the kind of people that do things haphazardly. They're disciplined, and they're not driven, John, by emotions. They are proactive rather than reactive. You can't run a successful business, start a successful business, without having a plan, a strategy. And you will find this with all successful people. I don't care in all walks of life, whether it's a successful athlete that trains and disciplines him or herself to the sport that they play, a successful actor who takes lessons, and successful entrepreneurs, politicians, all of them had a plan and they execute it. And that's one of the first things that you will see with successful people.
Well, they're basically doing what we're urging listeners to do, to have a plan. But besides that, there must be something else. At least you have to think that there has to be something else. I mean, shrewd investors can be shrewd, but they can't know everything. So how do they build that, what we call uncertainty factor, into their planning?
Well, in addition to having a plan, they also have great advisors. They have great tax people, legal advisors. So they minimize taxes that they pay. That's another attribute I've seen with very, very wealthy and successful people. I mean, take a guy like Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett has arranged Berkshire Hathaway as his own personal tax shelter. And one of the things that Warren Buffett is most proud of, in addition to, let's say, his success as an investor, is he has minimized his taxes. And as he's often said, he pays a lower tax rate than his secretary. But that's done intentionally. Warren Buffett makes most of his income from dividends and capital gains, which are taxed now at 20%, or under Bush, it was 15%. So they minimize the taxes they pay. They understand what their marginal tax bracket is, meaning if they invest additional dollars, how are those additional dollars are going to be taxed? And they arrange their investment portfolios in ways that minimize tax. If they're in interest income, they're in tax-free bonds because they don't want to pay 44% federal taxes. If they're in other investments, they're in stocks because dividends are taxed at 15 to 20% along with capital gains. That's where Warren Buffett gets all his income. Warren, second richest man in the world, is in a 20% tax bracket. You compare that to the average American, that's in 25 to 28. They are in tax shelter investments, which is what Berkshire Hathaway is. It's a personal holding corp in many ways. They keep more of what they make. Now, when you think about that, you earn a dollar. What good does it do you if you give up 40, 50, or close to 60% of that in federal and state taxes? They live in low tax states, no tax states, or minimize the taxes they pay. And that's why they built fortunes, created legacies, and why they're able to pass it on. It's why you hear about these great fortunes of so many great families, the Kennedys, the Rockefellers, the Astors, the Vanderbilts. And with wealthy, the thing about it is they can buy the best advice, and that's why their fortunes continue to grow. They can't know everything it is about taxes, but you can be sure they have the best tax advisors around.
It seems like it's pretty straightforward common sense, though. If you just understand what's happening and you take the appropriate action, then that's that. I mean, these people have a plan. They use advisors, and don't ever be afraid of advisors. You should always have really savvy people giving you some good input, because you can't know everything. But they use advisors to minimize taxes, to maximize refunds. They have their assets diversified. The diversification has just been one of those most principally simple concepts that's out there. And as a matter of fact, it goes back as far as biblical times. You find it in Proverbs, something as simple as diversification. Most of the experts you have on the program here always emphasize this diversification. It's taught in every investment course. But how many times, if you look at guests that you have on, email, statistics, this is not what investors are doing. They're trying to find that thing, whatever that thing happens to be, that's going to earn the money, or that thing that's secure. And as a result, they plop all their eggs in one basket, no plan beyond that, and a lot of times driven by that emotional gut roller coaster ride that's out there. You have to use reason and logic. Sometimes that means standing in the face of where the herd's running. You know, the problems you have is the herd's almost always running in the wrong direction, but you have to avoid getting trampled by the herd when you go the opposite direction. So they become swayed by headlines, media hype, whatever it happens to be. And it takes a certain amount of intestinal fortitude to do that. And let's just face it, because when everybody else is saying there's a big green dragon down on the corner, you tend to want to run away from the corner.
John, it reminds me of probably one of the worst economic times in this country, which was the Great Depression. You remember FDR's inaugural address. The only thing you have to fear is fear itself. And so many people today are driven by the emotional aspects of fear. And you need to understand that fear. And one way is to have a plan to overcome it. And, you know, it just makes so much sense. You can't pick one investment. Put all your money in gold. Okay, that's going to be the answer. Put all your money in bond funds, which investors have done since 2009. That's been the answer. Or all your money in cash, waiting endlessly for the day that the world ends or the crash finally comes. As we mentioned earlier, we will have another crash, but it's years away, and it'll be after we reach bubble territory and things just look silly. And everybody will be talking about how well the economy's doing, how much money they're going to make in stocks or whatever asset class this bubble is formed. But no one knows about the future. Not even the experts can predict it. But had you been diversified, you would have survived 2008, as we have talked so many times on this program. You would have thrived during the crisis. You wouldn't have experienced a loss of income, very little loss in assets. And had you just sat there, they would have came back. And I'm just talking about a simple strategy of stocks, bonds, and cash. And we've given examples of an actual case study, a case where half the assets, 50%, were in bonds, 40% in stocks, and about roughly 10% in cash. And during the very bottom of the crisis, the final bottom in March of 2009, the portfolio would have been down 7%. The income would have actually been going up. And that's the difference, John, between having a plan and not having a plan. You don't get swayed, because by that diversification process, while stocks were going down, bonds were going up, and cash was being held steady.
So as we look at retirement, once you're there, it's important that you stay there. That lets you do what you want to do rather than what you have to do. You have to have a plan to get you to retirement, to keep you retired, and to build a sizable nest egg, and then make that nest egg grow, because people are living longer. There are medical expenses that keep growing. Inflation is going to be a constant reality with us for quite some time to come, because the Fed strategies are producing it, and there's no sign that they're going to be able to get off of that bandwagon anyway in the near future. You need to have the prudence of diversification and sound investment advice. unless you're an expert, get expert advice. And frankly, even like they say to an attorney, if you're in court yourself for yourself, you're a fool. You need to have somebody else doing your own legal work, because somebody else can see things from a more objective position rather than those emotional things that we all tend to wrap up into. This is not complicated, people. This is common sense. And we also might add, don't procrastinate. There's a New Year's coming up. People make New Year's resolutions during the holidays. Actually, the holidays, Jim, are the time that Carol and I, when we get away from radio production, we can actually sit down and say, well, what are we doing in this other area? You know, you get a clearer head, assuming you're not drinking too much, you know. maybe after too many glasses of wine, the whole investment scenario looks pretty rosy, you know?
Yeah, you might have been in the bunker, but after a few drinks, hey, time to come out of the bunker.
Time to come out of the bunker. But if you write the plan down, you may be surprised by the plan when you get sober again. anyway, but in essence, have a plan, and that'll get you to retirement. Keep you retired, grow your nest egg, and if you need to, give some method of handing things off to your kids and grandkids.
I'm always amazed, John, and we see this happen all the time. You know, we start the holidays beginning next week, from Thanksgiving all the way to New Year's. We're going to be in the holiday festive mode, and people say, okay, I'm going to put everything off. I'll wait till next year. But with 6 weeks left, this is really important to do some planning, especially if you've had some windfall gains in the market this year, or maybe you have some losses that you need to use to offset gains that you've taken. Or maybe this year was a windfall year in terms of income. So you need to think about doing your tax planning. You don't want to wait until December 31st. You might want to contact your advisors, your CPA and attorney, and say, hey, I've got more income this year. What do I do? What are the steps taken? Especially if you're self-employed, because there's so many avenues that you can pursue in terms of pension options to reduce your tax bill. As long as you have the paperwork done by December 31st, you have until you file your taxes to fund your pension plan. So don't wait to New Year's Day to make a New Year's resolution. Hey, I'm going to get my act together. You need to act now and get documents in place. And especially if you've had a windfall year this year, the nice thing about pensions, as long as you have the document set up by December 31st, if you're a calendar year taxpayer, you have until you file your tax return and even through extensions to actually fund your pension. So don't procrastinate and wait till January, because there are so many things that you can do. We're going to be covering some of these in lifetime income here as we get closer to the end of the year. We've already talked about some year-end tax planning strategies. We're going to have a pension expert on the program. We're going to talk about charitable gifting, how to pick, let's say, a charity, or even set up a charitable foundation or a charitable remainder trust if you have some big gains that you're thinking of getting through. So anyway, don't wait. Don't procrastinate, because it can cost you a lot of money.
And as always here on the program, what we do is try to provide you a real life case study. The subjects are real. However, we change the name to protect their confidentiality and important details. Today, Paul and Kathy Krueger.
This was a situation where you had Paul, who was a surgeon in Boca Raton, Florida, currently employed by a hospital group, which means that he was a salaried employee, a wage earner, even though his salary was seven figures a year. And in his situation, like so many people that move into the upper income groups, he wanted to reduce his taxes. And he also wanted to invest in a way that minimized his taxes, because he was smart enough to know that any additional dollars, whether it was interest or any form of income from his investments, capital gains, would be taxed. And he didn't want to add to his tax bracket, because his goal was he wanted to retire early. There were a lot of things he wanted to do. They loved golf, and especially travel was very big. They take quite a few vacations with their children. And so what he had is he had roughly a big pension plan with the group that he was with. He also had $1.5 million in taxable investment accounts currently invested in junk bonds. And actually he did okay with that, because junk bonds in many ways act almost like equities. When interest rates go down, and the economy improves, because those high yields, people will bid that up. And especially in this kind of investment environment where we've seen two-year treasury notes go from 2006, when they were 5%, down to a little over 0.3%. And so in junk bonds, those yields were very rich. If you had bought them in 2009, you were getting yields in the double-digit range. So you can imagine now, when they're closer to 6%, how much money you made. And his goal was to get a 10% return after taxes. The problem is he is in a high tax bracket, 44% in the federal bracket. Now, fortunately, he was a doctor practicing in Florida. Florida has no income taxes. But as I tried to explain to him, if he wanted a 10% after-tax return, you add 39.6%, which is the Obamacare tax rate, add on top of that the Obamacare medical tax at 3.8%, he needed to earn 17.7% to have 10% after tax. Now, if he had short-term capital gains, same thing, almost 17.7%. Now, the one advantage, as I explained to him, is if he was in stocks, which, by the way, if he wanted to retire early, his goal of getting maybe a 10% rate of return, you know, the nice thing about being in stocks, that was how he was going to get to his objective. He wasn't going to get to his objective by going into tax-free bonds. At the time we did this case, the yields on tax-free bonds were probably anywhere from 2.5% to 3%. You're not going to build a fortune at 2.5% and 3%, even though you're not going to pay taxes. So dividends in his bracket would be taxed at 20% plus the Obama tax of 3.8%. So he would only have to earn a 13% rate of return. Now, as I explained to him, part of that would be taxed. If you look at total return on stocks, dividends would be taxed at that 23.8%. But capital gains could be deferred, exactly what Warren Buffett does. If you have a good growth stock that's growing, you sit on it. If you own a Coca-Cola, you sit on it. You own a Procter & Gamble, you sit on it. You own an Exxon, you sit on it, and you defer the gains. Because until you sell that stock, you don't have to pay the other part. So part of the total return of earning 10% or even 13% would come partially from dividends, and the other part would come from capital gains. And we looked at tax-free bonds, and his goal of having a reasonable income, he wanted to have an income of close to $25,000 a month when he retired, given his salary and given their goal that they wanted to spend a lot of time going to places, you know, spend 6 weeks in Europe, go to China, go to South America, do the things that they wanted, would take that kind of money. And I don't need to tell you, if you do a lot of foreign travel today, just take a look at what it costs you to fly first class from here to Europe, here to, you know, Asia or any place. It costs a small fortune, not counting what it's going to cost if you stay in a nice hotel, or to mention what you're going to be spending at restaurants. And so he wanted that kind of income. And I told him, I said, look, you know, I can put you in tax-free bonds. I can get you 2.5% and 3%, but that's not going to get you to your retirement goal.
Now, this has me curious, because I always wonder, you hear about all these TV stars that, you know, suddenly they owe $6 million to the IRS. And I keep thinking, with all the money you make, how did you ever get in such a position? You know, so what do? You have a guy who makes over, what, $1 million a year? How did you solve his tax problem?
And you're seeing this done in the medical profession today, where a lot of doctors who are part of a group will end up going on their own and be consultants within that group. And by going off on their own, they can set up their own company. So instead of getting paid a salary, they get paid a gross sort of consulting fee. And with that, they can set up various pension plans instead of a simple 401k, which is what he had at work, which, given his age, you know, he would be limited to $17,500 a year. I mean, when you're making seven figures, folks, that's a drop in the bucket. It's not going to do anything when it comes to taxes. If he went on his own, he had a number of options. Number one, he could go with a SEP IRA, which would get him up over $50,000. What we did in this particular case is got him with an actuary, and we set up a defined benefit pension plan. And as a result of that, he was able to put aside several hundred thousand dollars a year. Basically, the government was funding almost half of it. And by putting aside several hundred thousand dollars a year, you do that over a 10-year period, you know, that's $2 million alone, not counting any gains in the assets. So the first thing was incorporating on his own, going to a consultant, setting up a defined benefit pension plan. And then the other thing that we did is we said, look, you're 45 years old. you're still at that age where you want to be going for growth. And if your goal is to retire at age 60, you've got 15 years ahead of you. Yes, at some point in time, you might want to scale back on some of your stocks if we get up to bubble territory. You might want to take some gains, protect yourself with puts, which is what I would recommend when we get to the bubble territory. But stocks, we're going to be taxed at a 20% tax bracket or 23 versus the 44% bracket of ordinary income, which is what he was paying on his junk bonds. And besides that, his junk bonds, you know, they were down to a 6% yield. And you could get that in almost, a stock like Royal Dutch Petroleum. And so what we did is we converted a lot of his portfolio into dividend paying stocks that would be dividend reinvested. And so he would accumulate, because obviously with the salary, he didn't need the income. But by using a defined benefit pension plan, we were able to bring down his taxes and save him well over six figures a year in taxes. And then also various expenses, write-offs, cars, etc. And so here, John, what we were doing is redeploying investments in a tax-favored way, which is what wealthy people do. You know, which would you rather pay? 44% tax on interest income from a junk bond at 6%, or would you rather pay 23.8% on a dividend? Not to mention the fact that I would venture to say investing in Exxon, a Johnson & Johnson, a Procter & Gamble, and Coca-Cola are a lot safer investments than C or CCC rated bonds, even though the economy is doing well and junk bonds have responded as well. But the gains in the stock market far exceeded anything he had achieved in junk bonds. And so in this scenario, the simple answer to his solution was becoming a self-employed individual, setting up a defined benefit pension plan that allowed him to put more money away on a tax-deferred basis so that he could reach his retirement goals. I mean, you know, you think about it, 15 years of putting aside $200,000 a year, because in a defined benefit pension plan, you could fund for a $250,000 retirement, which is pretty close to his goal of $25,000 a month or $300,000 a year. And then secondarily, turning his own personal investments, because he continued to save personally, into tax-favored investments in the form of dividends. And we do have some master limited partnerships in there with dividend yields close to what he was getting in junk bonds. The major difference is a good 60 to 70% of the dividend was tax sheltered. So here was a combination, John, of turning an individual that was an employee to self-employed. And as a result of that, using probably the best pension plan available for single individuals, self-employed, or a small corporation, a defined benefit pension plan. You see this with movie stars. You see these used frequently with athletes, because it allows for these people in high income brackets to fund for $250,000 at retirement. And so here basically was shifting the investment portfolio from something that was safer in something that was more tax favored, tax advantage, and also using a defined benefit pension plan to reduce his taxable income.
And now coming up next, Dr. Drew Collins from the San Diego Clinic of Naturopathic Medicine, preventing heart disease and what to do if you have it. Coming up next at financialsense.com.
Each year, 600,000 people die of heart disease in the United States. That accounts for one in every four deaths. More than half of the deaths due to heart disease were in men. And 720,000 Americans have a heart attack each year. Coronary heart disease alone costs the United States close to $110 billion each year. That includes the cost of healthcare services, medications, and lost productivity. Joining me on the program today is Dr. Drew Collins from the San Diego Clinic of Preventive Medicine. And doctor, how much of this that we see in heart disease today is due to hereditary factors, and how much of it is due to lifestyle, in your opinion?
Well, good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me on the show again, and hi to all the listeners. You know, a huge part of what we're driven by is our genetics, and now there's a new field called epigenetics where you can actually change your genes with your lifestyle and diet and behavior. But let's say mostly you have to figure out what you inherited from your parents and that's your job in your 20s and 30s and start realizing that you're looking like your parents. But if you have heart disease in the family, that's one of the first things that doctors want to ask. Is it hereditary? Are you going down the same path? So I would say you're given this body, and it's up to you to either fall apart right on schedule or change the program.
Part of it, as a doctor, you're going to look and see, gee, do you have a history of heart disease in your family? Because that's going to tell you somewhat genetically if you're predisposed to it. Now, let's talk about lifestyle. Obviously, stress, diet, lack of exercise. How much does that play in heart disease today?
Hugely. That's why you always hear, even places like Kaiser and the big insurance companies, it's to their advantage to get people walking and get their diet changed and de-stress, and everyone's hearing what they should be doing because they know that a little early on in your life makes a big difference in the outcomes later, and these are the kind of habits you start having to add to your behavior as much as possible and chip away at it. So you can't just do everything when you're 60. You got to start when you're 40. And it's even better if you've heard about it when you're 20. So that's the thing about lifestyle, is you chip away at it, and it doesn't happen easy. It's got to be taught. You got to model a behavior after somebody you like or your family or someone's told you, but it doesn't stick the first time someone tells you. So you got to keep hearing it from the public service announcements, from the doctor, from Oprah, from, you know, Dr. Oz and your friend, and, oh, I'm going walking. You want to go with me? And, you know, a cup of wine in the afternoon and stuff. You hear it over the popular culture, and pretty soon it's allowed that you're making these changes. But it takes years, really.
Dr. Collins, let's take a very famous politician, former President Bill Clinton. He had quadruple bypass. A year later, he had a collapsing artery and he had to have a stent put in. But then a doctor got a hold of him, Dr. Dean Ornish. He changed his diet and he's never looked better. So once you have clogged arteries, in the case of President Clinton, how long does it take to reverse it? And is it, in the president's case, reversible with exercise, the proper diet? It's my understanding he's a vegetarian now, but can you reverse the damage that is done over a lifetime of poor diet and stress?
Yes, but I always tell people that it has to be like an Olympic effort. So it's not that you can't take the body and turn it back to a pristine state. It's that most of us are hesitant to make huge changes in our social order or behavior or whatever. So it's not that the tissue can't respond. And in the case of someone like Bill Clinton, he's an example of, I think he passed an executive echocardiogram before he went into this. And him and Tim Russert are a good example. They had these massive heart attacks after they passed the executive stress test because those pipes, those coronary arteries, and to a certain extent, the circulation in general, can adapt to a great extent without you knowing it. So the flow of blood through that demand for these people that might have been plugged, even as much as 70%, still there's elasticity and you can get the blood down to where it needs to get under stress. So you don't notice there's a problem until that last little breakthrough plaque that plugs the whole thing, and then you get a massive heart attack. So it's deceptive if you've passed some of these popular analytical tests to see how your blood's flowing without really getting down. And now the new technology looks at the thickness, the actual thickness and elasticity of those pipes, those arteries, and that's where everything's going. It's going to inflammation, and pathology accumulates way earlier, and there's even blood tests now, super sensitive blood tests. So you can get into a test now way, way, way early than Bill Clinton did and not be shocked by this thing. So to answer your question, though, yes, you can reverse it.
Doctor, I know there are a lot of tests that you go in on an annual basis for your physical. You know, you get your blood tests, you take a look at your cholesterol, your triglycerides, and all the things that doctors tend to look at. But there are some new tests. I'm trying to think of the machine. It's called an O-ring. It's almost like a short CAT scan, and it can measure the plaque in the main arteries. What about tests like that that can alert the patient to early detection of a possible heart attack or the onset of heart disease?
Right. Well, again, getting back to this key buzzword, inflammation now, and I think it's been on front of Time magazine and everything, is what used to be cholesterol, fat, and all that kind of stuff in the 70s and 80s, and now there's some good fats and bad fats. Now everyone's jumping on the inflammation bandwagon. And inflammation in most of these diseases can be accumulated through excess blood sugar and free radical damage and a lot of things that can get soaked up by the food and the diet and even some supplements. But to answer your question about the testing, there's a tremendous availability of blood tests. that screen for this inflammatory marker is very specific about the coronary arteries and heart disease specifically. The one to kind of have your listeners take home is the CRP, C-reactive protein. That's probably available to people who have insurance and they want their doctor to bump it up a notch, because a lot of the new sophisticated stuff won't be covered yet. So you can go in and have a soup to nuts buffet of new neat tests that will tell you the gnat's eyebrows of what's bad or right, but you won't get it covered and it might end up being expensive. But if the C-reactive protein, and they say highly sensitive or highly specific for the cardiac system, is available now, and that's way better than saying, oh, my cholesterol or even some of these other things, and they just often don't want to pay for it because it's a little more expensive and kind of outside the box. But that's enough in the conventional wisdom now that that's a marker for inflammation. So C-reactive protein is one that everybody can go and ask for. They also want to keep their blood sugar levels in check. Insulin levels, there's another one called hemoglobin A1C that everybody can ask for. That's pretty much conventional wisdom enough now that good doctors are asking for that. That's a long-term view of how much sugar's in your system, and literally sticky blood is inflamed blood. And then as far as the radiological or high-tech type tests that you're asking about, there's a thing called a coronary intimal medial thickness scan. It's not an ultrasound like blood flow. It actually shows you the thickness, and you can see the plaque and the vulnerable plaque and the soft plaque, they call it, in the coronary arteries. And it's non-invasive, kind of an ultrasound test, but it's very specific and actually can see what's going on in your thickness and how elastic or lack of elasticity it has and how much accumulated plaque. You can actually see the plaque. And then there's basically CAT scans and other versions of that where you can do dye and be a little more invasive, intravenous dye, and then they do a CAT scan on you. So all those things are available, and the only thing stopping it is people usually want to have their insurance cover it, or Obamacare cover it, or whatever. And usually those yeses happen at a much lower level of basic tests. And so the one that I think would be available to almost anybody is the C-reactive protein and the hemoglobin A1C. Almost every doctor in every town in the country would know what that is and would probably wince a little bit and say, yeah, let's look for that. Those are way better than the old-fashioned just HDL and LDL on the cholesterol. But if you want to really get down to specifics, they have companies now that draw blood, and you have to have a requisition from a doctor. But they'll look at every imaginable little fragment of the lipids in these little balls called low-density lipoproteins, and high-density lipoproteins are actually little cholesterol and phospholipid balls. And the ratio and the bands of lipoprotein around them, they can analyze every one of those things for doctors that like to do that. But again, those type of things are usually considered not mainstream. They are real, and they're really good to help you get very specific about your risk. So you can do blood tests. Then there's low-invasive ultrasound called CIMT, and then there's any number of things that are more invasive, like CAT scans and that kind of thing. So it depends on how you're paying for it and where you live and what doctors are doing it.
Doctor, this CRP, is this something that should be done every single year, just like when you go in for your annual physical, you have your blood drawn?
Yes, that's one that they should put on there. Just like everything else, there's whole regions of screening. Like they'll do TSH, which is a thyroid hormone that comes with the pituitary gland, thyroid-directing hormone and thyroid-secreting hormone. And they'll just check that in the blood to see if the whole thyroid system is okay. And that'll be on a panel. So you'll do a once-a-year panel. And the CRP would be very appropriately the one test to check a lot of things. And the hemoglobin A1C, nowadays, doctors are asking for that because that's way better than just a snapshot of your blood sugar. So your answer is yes. And places like Life Extension, which is a membership-based thing where they can do lab tests for you, will throw that in there. And even things like testosterone and some of the other male hormones or female hormones, it's starting to become, it's a boutique, you know, everyone's asking for it, who knows the business. But now more and more people are starting to get those on panels. And you're right, that should be once a year type of thing.
Doctor, let's assume that your blood tests come up and it shows that you're prone to heart disease, your cholesterol, your triglycerides. What would be the first steps that, let's say, a patient would want to take to make sure that they're on the path to recovery? Are there things they can do to clean out their arteries? Obviously, if you change your diet and stop eating fatty food, you start losing weight, you start exercising, you're going to help your good cholesterol versus bad cholesterol. There's supplements. I mean, what are the steps? Let's say I come in to see you. you do this test and it shows that my cholesterol is high, my CRP test looks risky. What do you recommend?
Okay, well, it's like anything else. It's like saying, I want to be a singer. So there's, you know, singing in the shower, then there's all the way up to battle with the stars in Hollywood. So a person who comes and asks the doctor for help, they usually do blood tests. And the blood tests are, as we said, basic all the way up to $1,000. And then there's usually a dialogue of like, well, this shows you the state that you're in as far as inflammation and as far as hereditary, you know, tendencies and that kind of thing. So it's very easy to get to the level of conversation where you and a doctor are talking about blood work. And that's what we do in our office. The next level is when it comes to heart disease or diabetes, which is kind of like one leads into the other, we have a thing called chelation here. And I know that we've talked about that a lot. Chelation is a little bit controversial, but a lot of people have done it, hundreds of thousands of people. And the idea is that you're taking heavy metals out of the body, and the heavy metals are one source of inflammation and toxicity, like lead and cadmium and mercury and that sort of thing. You're not supposed to have any in there, but we all accumulate it. So intravenously or even orally, there's EDTA, which is a molecule that attaches to the positively charged heavy metals. So depending on the person and depending on what's going on with their feedback with their lab work, we often suggest, look, you need to find out if you have heavy metals in you as one of the risk factors. So we do an actual challenge. They take EDTA intravenously. They pee out the heavy metals that's attached to the EDTA, analyze it. We can tell which heavy metals are there and how much it's going to take to get it out of there. And besides supplementation, everything from garlic to hawthorn berry to phospholipids to carnitine, there's wonderful amino acids and plants and protovitamins and all sorts of things that are very good for heart disease as well as metabolic syndrome, diabetes, that kind of thing. So we recommend supplements. Then we also talk about intravenous work here. The intravenous work not only gets rid of the heavy metals, but also supercharges them with things like arginine. Arginine is an amino acid that works with nitric oxide. It dilates the peripheral capillary bed, gets blood to where it isn't. So if someone's having angina or chest pains, you know, they used to take the little nitro pill under their tongue. That's the same idea. But arginine is a safe thing that we can do intravenously. You can actually take it as pills. So we're very cardio-nutritionally oriented, and we like working with, for example, Dr. Sinatra's got books out there. He's a metabolic cardiologist. He's got a lot of programs out there that you can get a handle on. And it's very similar to that. We do supplements, and we do intravenous things, and we do lifestyle stuff. Gets back to gentle walking at first, eventually a little more light weights, free weights, a little resistance training. We don't do that here, but that's lifestyle stuff. And it's slow for each person, but they can start turning around where they pretty quickly don't have the chest pains. They're still kind of at risk. You mentioned cholesterol. Let's say their triglycerides are all off. Sometimes it's a thyroid problem. Sometimes it's not as easy as just saying, oh, don't eat fat, because there's good fats that we got to introduce. There's a nutritional conversation there. So it's a lot of stress because it's different, and often they have to pay money because we're a cash practice here, but whether they go to their cardiologist or their nutritionist or their chiropractic physician or whoever they go to, they're going to be having a dialogue where someone's going to tell them to do things that they may not be doing, and that's where the stress level goes up, because often we go home and eat a donut because we had a bad day, or last thing we want to do is go out and walk outside of the house when we're grumpy. But if you're on the program where you're either afraid of dying or you're watching somebody else get healthy and you want to do it too, that's where you need the coaching. And that's often where some people are successful and some people aren't. And they're trainable or teachable, and doesn't matter really how bad you are, if you're ready to change and, you know, you'll listen, then we can take amazing turnarounds. And some people might not be very trainable and they may not be that sick, but they don't change because they're blocking every step of the way. So for us, when they come here, we do lab work. We talk about chelation because we're specialists in that. We talk about heavy metal toxicity. We talk about getting cardiac metabolic nutrition into them. And then we direct them to different things like lifestyle things, and we direct them to things like going back to the gym, or they might go to Pilates, or they might do something like walking and doing social interaction with people. So part of being healthy is getting back into your world, and doesn't mean you can't be stressed at work. I mean, there's a sort of a in-the-game part of being active that we don't tell them not to do. You don't have to be quiet all the time. It's actually good to kind of stimulate yourself. So we're not opposed to people working hard, and we're not opposed to people getting angry, and we're not opposed to people getting their heart rate up, but the idea is you want to have balance. So some of what people haven't learned in our culture is balance. I'm a naturopathic doctor, so the idea is we're following the courses of nature and the things that you can see as far as animals and seasons and natural behaviors. And so we can address things like, oh, you're not sleeping. Well, that's going to be a problem for your total goals. So even though we come in for their heart, they aren't sleeping. That's got to be addressed. And that's a classic example. Or something like, I never eat breakfast. Well, you know, even though you may not want to eat breakfast or you never have, that's going to be a problem as far as the long-term sugar in your body. So it's nutrition, it's lifestyle, it's what you're worried about. If they come in with pathology like pains in their chest, or they just came from a cardiologist and they got a stent in their heart, a lot of times we get them when they're not healthy. That's the problem. They've already, you know, had their fun, and now they're 75, and now they're saying, hey, I want to do something natural. So that's a little harder, but unfortunately, they don't come in often when they're 20. So for us, we have to use a little more advanced and interventive things like IVs or concentrated supplements. But if they're 20 and they do have heart disease in their family, they can do some simple stuff, you know, fish oils and a few supplements and this and that, and get into the light exercise stuff and baby into it so it's not so dramatic. But like I said, we usually get them when they have some pathology already.
Let me bring up an individual who was a patient of one of your predecessors at the clinic, and that's somebody that's well known in the financial world, which is Richard Russell. He had bypass surgery. I think it was his fourth heart attack, he wrote in his newsletter, where his attorney said, you know, get your financial affairs in order. He discovered one of your predecessors there at the clinic and discovered chelation. And over a period of time, he has gone through chelation. His arteries have been cleaned out. And, you know, that was age 70. Richard is in his 80s today and quite healthy. He changed his diet. So even though you may have a history of heart disease and, let's say, lifestyle bad choices that you've made, whether it's diet, you've got hereditary factors working against you, maybe you had stress, he was able to turn it around. And gosh, you know, at age 70, when his attorney was saying, get your financial affairs in order, here he is, what, 12, 15 years later.
Yeah, well, that's not uncommon. And again, they're teachable. And usually people who are entrepreneurs are very savvy. They come in, they go, look, I'm in charge of this. And what do you got? And we lay it out for them. And they said, yeah, I agree. I just researched that on the internet. So they come in with like an inch thick of documents. And they know what they want by the time I talk to them usually. And that goes very quickly and well, and it's fairly comfortable to make changes because they're ready to go. So again, even though they were 70 and they've kind of accumulated a lot of bumps and lumps along the way, with the formulas that we use and the quality of supplements that are being made now in the marketplace, you can get some dramatic changes, and the body's amazingly resilient. It wants to get better. So we don't worry if someone comes in and they're very bad off if they got the right mind, you know. Cardiac disease is hereditarily given to you, and then you spend a whole long time getting sick from it, meaning like 30 years or 40 years, and it takes time to reverse it, but you can reverse it. It just nicely reverses if you do all the right things, but you have to participate. So that's the problem. And the people who are usually small business owners where it matters, you know, they have to take care of their own health. They've usually thought outside the box. People have traveled. People who are usually, like I said, entrepreneurs get it as far as the accountability and the fact that it's on their shoulders to really do the stuff at home. Because no matter how many times you go to the doctor can only see you so often, but you've got to do it one walk around the block at a time. And that's what the decision is based on. So health comes from their own behavior. We can direct them, and amazing things can happen. I had a guy who had, I think it was four stents in his heart, and, you know, they were going to do a bypass. They almost never do bypasses anymore, and he basically could have died any minute. And he ended up doing our program, and he ended up walking the whole Spanish Pilgrim's Path, which was like 600 miles of gentle walking. But we got him up to speed where he survived that and was better than ever. That was a life goal of his. You know, he doesn't have any heart pain anymore. But, you know, he got busy. He took a handful of supplements. He got tons of chelation. He did everything we told him to, and we still were crossing our fingers because he was so bad when he walked in, but he had a goal 6 months later that he was going to walk this, you know, spiritual journey in Spain, and it worked out for him. So, and he was not a young guy. He was a super stressed out guy in his 70s, but he changed. You know, got rid of the stress for one thing. That's one of the things that he had to do for him, and this pilgrimage thing was his goal, so he got it.
So, Doctor, I guess maybe the key things are, because we've seen, I'm trying to think of the actor that played Tony in The Sopranos, who died unexpectedly in a heart attack.
Yeah, Gandolfini.
Yeah. And the other thing that we're seeing too is, and I've seen it, where people are dying of heart attacks at a younger age, in their 40s. So no matter what your age, I guess the first thing you should be aware of, what you're telling me is, does heart disease run in the family? So if you had a grandfather or father had heart problems, a mother, grandmother, that's your first alert that, hey, maybe I could have those genes too.
By 35, you've already got atherosclerosis in your coronary arteries. So if you got it in your family, then you've already got it, unless you were raised by Mennonites or something and you only eat foreign fresh food. But even then, so it's not as easy as just saying, oh, I eat good food. It's, your tendency is to accumulate inflammation in those places of your heart, which is a bad deal. But then the good news is you're probably not going to die of cancer. So if you can get on it and get after what causes atherosclerosis, and some people say it's just a vitamin C deficiency. You know, some people say it's an inflammation thing. It's multifaceted. You know, homocysteine, there's different genetic markers, which we can check now. Poor methylation, all these kind of things are many daggers coming at the heart that you got to keep an eye on. Vitamin D levels, we're finding so much more about vitamin D. So just going into it, if you know that both sides you have heart disease and you're 25 and you're looking around at life and thinking I'm invincible, that's when it's reasonable to start going down a list and checking off some of the boxes, dietary changes, behavior, etc. Often you don't even have doctors that you talk to when you're in your 20s. But it's already happening. If you're living the high life, it's already happening that you're accumulating heart disease silently. And by the time you're 35, you could have a heart attack because your coronary arteries are already plugged. Even though you look young, it could happen. So it's not such a shock that whatever James's age was in his 40s or whatever, that's not shocking to me that he would die of a heart attack.
So the first step is to take a look at your health history, hereditary factors that may come into play with your parents. The second thing you should do on your physical, and let's remind our listeners for that, because everybody usually when they go for their physical, they check, you know, your cholesterol,
yeah,
what's your good guys, what's your bad
right
guys, your triglycerides. You're suggesting another test, the CRP, which sort of measures inflammation.
And that's enough on the buzz now that the average doctor will know what it is, and you could ask, and they'll, like, even for Kaiser or something, they'll say, oh, yeah, we'll throw it in. They don't want to throw it in because it costs more than just a cholesterol. But it's way more information. And the other thing that's just entry-level information is how much sugar you have in your bloodstream. And that's what causes inflammation for the average person. I mean, infection notwithstanding, let's say you don't have an infection or something. Most people don't have that going on. But the average 30-year-old who gets a blood work once a year or something, besides just, oh, you're fine, your cholesterol's fine, you want to ask for a couple more things. And one of them I would say is figure out this CRP thing, figure out the hemoglobin A1C, and that's like how much sugar you got floating around on an average, which does tend to make inflammation and does tend to make heart disease. So that's a big one to catch on a low-level screen before you do all these elaborate other stuff, which you could do. I mean, come in at 25 and say, hey, I've got $1,000, you know, run every test in the book. But most people don't think that way.
There's enough buzz on the CRP test today so that if you go in, let's say you're a member of Scripps, you know, some of the HMOs, if you request that as part of your physical, most doctors will go along with that?
Yes, and the hemoglobin A1C, too. They know what it is. They'll do it. And that's a lot of information. That's a whole nother chunk of information that this screening, this inflammatory concept, and you're catching it early. And there's a few other things. There's things like genetic markers now that are a little more out there. They have to have a different test. It's like a cell test, a genetic test. But there's things to screen things. More and more epigenetics where people are being able to be singled out and say, oh, you're at higher risk for this because, you know, you're this one person that's this genetic marker. So with all the research that's coming up now, there's tests as well as drugs that are making it easier and easier for people to be treated before they get bad. And the problem is that if you don't ask, if you're not interested in this, and you wait for your average doctor to tell you, they're 10 years behind. So you're going to miss out on early preventative stuff that you could be getting just because you didn't ask for it. And the other doctor was encouraged not to do more tests. They're encouraged to do less tests. Right, which is a cost-cutting thing, but at the same time, you're the squeaky wheel. So you're saying, hey, look, I'll pay for this on my own, or I'll go around the corner and get it somewhere else. That's the people that usually are winning the game, is the one that don't wait for everybody else to catch up. They're out there asking.
So as we sum up, there's a couple things you can do if you're predisposed. Number one, look at heredity. Take a look at your genetics in your family. Secondly, the CRP test that you can get done. And I think maybe the good news here is no matter what your conditions are, if you're diligent and consistent, you can reverse heart disease, as we're seeing in so many people, whether it's Richard Russell at age 70 after his fourth heart attack and bypass surgery, now living into his 80s. We're seeing Bill Clinton looking healthier than ever. Doctor, are there any books out there that you recommend that our listeners might want to read?
Well, I mentioned Dr. Steven Sinatra, MD, he's a metabolic cardiologist, and anything like the Sinatra Solution, these are easy reads because he puts it in a layman's term, but it's basically his transformation. He's got a couple books out. His transformation from a regular cardiologist to now a metabolic or a nutritional cardiologist, where he sees how we can get in early and prevent this disease stuff, or even when they have disease, of keeping them from progressing to early death. So anything by Sinatra, just like Frank Sinatra's spelling, you can get it in Amazon or in Barnes & Noble, whatever. And that gets you used to saying words like carnitine, which is a supplement that's super important for the metabolic activity of the heart muscle, or arginine, which is important for nitric oxide distribution at the tips of the circulation where you get more blood flow down to that cardiac muscle so it doesn't scream at you. Magnesium, all these wonderful electrolytes that we are all depleted in. Even good old-fashioned garlic and hawthorn are old herbal friends. So he's not opposed to talking about herbs. He's not opposed to talking about research. And you can kind of take that book and plop it on the table of the doctor that you're seeing and go, hey, see this stuff they're talking about in here? Can't I get this too? And there'll be kind of a grumbling and a few, you know, flushed cheeks because you caught them without being aware of what's the latest thing. But if you're not too rude and are willing to maybe pay a little bit extra, you can get the most cutting-edge stuff. And I will just end by saying, if you stay around another 10 years, if we can keep ourselves alive, there's such amazing stuff coming out of medicine from like the stem cell division of research. And we worked with Dr. Howe here, who works with cardiac myocytes, and what we can do with people's hearts, even in their 80s, by regenerating from the baby stem cells on out to brand new cardiac function. So if you can hang around long enough, that's spreading all around the world, and better lab techniques and better availability for people, it's going to be a really remarkable cardiological opportunity very quickly. So just stay alive another 5 years, you know, is what I'm saying to the people who are in their 80s and kind of saying, well, what's left for me? So every 5 years is like doubling and tripling what's available.
This is the great thing that we're seeing with medical advances today. We have better screening, we have better testing, we have more knowledge. And also, you know, there are things that you can do from supplements, from lifestyle, from diet, exercise, where you don't have to rely on two of the favorite solutions, which is surgery and, you know, take a drug. So there's a lot of good news coming here. Doctor, if our listeners would like to find out more about the work that you guys do at Preventive Medicine in San Diego, how could they do so, please?
Okay, so I'm Dr. Drew Collins, and I've been in practice about 30 years, so I've got a lot of momentum going here, and I'll come up with something no matter what. But we have a team of doctors here, and it's the San Diego Clinic of Integrative Medicine, and our email is info@sandiegohealthclinic.com. So that's sandiegohealthclinic.com, and our phone number is 619-440-338. And we've taken patients, and we look forward to meeting people if they want to talk to us.
Doctor, well, listen, thanks so much for joining us on the program, and we wish you well, sir, and thanks for bringing us up to date on all the hopeful possibilities for combating heart disease. You have a great day.
Great. You too. Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Drew Collins, and once again, he was involved in a medical practice. His former partners, one of them who had passed on, was a doctor to Richard Russell. Richard Russell had heart disease, and basically, after bypass surgery and a heart attack at age 70, basically, a doctor he had at the time said, hey, go talk to your estate planning attorney. Richard today is alive in his 80s and healthy as a result of some of the steps from chelation, changing diet, and other things that extended his life. So I hope that you found that helpful. If you are having heart disease, as Drew talked about, there are so many advances coming down the road. There's so many blood tests that you can get today that can discover the disease early, and you can reverse it. Highly recommend you read Dean Ornish's book, Spectrum, Dr. Sinatra's book, The Sinatra Approach, as Drew talked about in that interview. There's several things that you can do to reverse heart disease. Let's face it, you worked hard, you built up your retirement assets, now you're in retirement. Wouldn't it be nice to live a healthy retirement? So we hope this helps. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant holiday week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk. We'll be right back.